news out, so we're
hope this works.
We're working our best on this, on the recording and various things to make up for his absence. All right, so hopefully we have microphones working now. That screen isn't great, so, but let me know if you have problems. We can try to adjust the windows. Good. Thank you all for making it. It's a little humbler than usual, but there are a few cookies there if anybody's so wishing. So we don't have any interns with us today. We do still have one staying on staff for the summer, but I wanted to just kind of go on record thanking we have two who you all met in the past, Monica Murphy and Solana Gillis, and they have gone back to their law school ways. We have one more staying on, Andrew's with us, and then we're actually going to have another one before long. So we're not going to probably hit you up for, you know, just a one, it's University of Chicago, that quarter system thing they have there, I'm told. So she's kind of off sync with the rest of them. But if you do hear of like interesting things or events that might be, you know, let us know. We'd love to kind of have our late coming intern.
She
Morgan.
Because her weeks here are when?
Yeah, so she'll start next week through September.
Mid-September.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, it's different scheduling for them. Anyway, that said, schedule. I sent out a schedule for the next fiscal year. I didn't hear any concerns back, and it just continues this current pattern we have. First Wednesdays of the month, 10 a.m. And so we'll calendar that. I'll send out an Outlook invite. I know some people found that helpful last time, so I'll do that in case it is. Hearing no objections, though, we'll stick with that. The next meeting is going to be September 5th. So again, first Wednesday of the month in September, September 5th. The only other kind of date to kind of put on your radar now is on September 14th is the due date for this last batch of new docs on disorderly conduct, writing, and merger, kind of the main ones there. I think that's it for preliminary announcements. So let's jump in. I thought we'd reverse the order a little bit and tackle accomplice liability first and the written comments on that. And there were just a couple things I think Michael wanted to kind of note or address on the written comments we got on accomplice liability. Then, you know, of course, open it up if there's anything more you all would like to discuss at this point. So, Michael?
Yeah, so thank you to OAGAPS for submitting thoughtful comments. There's just two things I thought from our perspective was worth raising with the group, and then be happy to address anything else that was submitted in the comments. One, and they're, I think, mostly just clarificatory points. One, OAG made a point about clarifying that in a situation where an accomplice assists a principal, but the principal doesn't make it to a completed offense, only makes it as far as an attempt, that in that situation, an accomplice could be held liable for the attempt. And that's something that, like, you know, staff agrees with, and that is addressed actually in the second paragraph of the commentary, and then with the accompanying footnote 4, that specific example is given. Footnote 2. For example, where A purposely assists P with a bank robbery scheme that ultimately fails because the police intervene right before P is able to enter the bank, A can be convicted as an accomplice to P's attempted robbery. And the accompanying text there is clarification that note that the reference to an offense include general employee crimes such as criminal attempt, solicitation, or conspiracy, all of which may serve as the basis for accomplice liability.
I think my problem is more with commission of an offense. Does the term commission of an offense mean
completed act.
A completed act, because it sounds like commission.
Right.
When you look it up, means that it has to be done. And so I granted it's in the commentary, but the question is, do we need to clarify it?
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, I hear the point. I think you would say that someone committed an attempt. Right, or no, maybe you wouldn't.
I don't.
I think you said committed blank or attempted blank.
Yeah,
got it. Okay. All right. Well, then we'll think a little bit more on that. But yeah, so it's just a question, point of clarification. But in terms of the policy, then
and the same thing with in is similar for innocent or responsible.
Right.
Person.
Right. Yeah. And then the other point. So OAG gave an example where. So basically the fact pattern is as follows. You have a principal who approaches one corrupt police officer and says, if you can convince another corrupt police officer who is going to be on duty in the place and time when I'm going to commit a crime, I'll give you a portion of the proceeds. So this corrupt police officer one, AA, then approaches officer A and says, you know, encourages him to refrain from stopping the crime from happening. And, you know, OAG's comment was, you know, going towards, like, the clarifying that it is possible to encourage an offense by omission. And so I think analytically, staff would kind of view that a little bit differently. But again, I think it's just a point of clarification. So in that situation, I would say that AA has assisted P in commission of the bank robbery by encouraging A to refrain from committing it. And that analytically, to dispose in that situation, the sort of like clearest and most direct way of dealing with that would be prong one, the assistance prong, rather than prong two, the encouragement prong. Because where one person encourages someone to refrain from doing something, but that's a direct means of assistance in the planning or commission of an offense committed by P in that situation. It's a little confusing because the assistance is committed by means of encouragement.
Yeah.
But I would say that that's probably best conceptualized as assistance rather than encouragement.
Can I just do a quick timeout? I've just texted Renata to say we're going to hang up the phone. And if she ever wants to join, she can just text me back and
we'll
call back in, and that way we don't have to do that.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
So point of order.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Sorry. No, I thought you guys were reading.
No. I was waiting.
Yeah. Oh, all right. Cool. Well, thank you for clarifying. So that's.
I'll speak up.
Okay. All the other comments are things that we will definitely take into consideration, and we feel like clearly understand, you know, what the comment is. Happy to talk more, but.
Was there anything else on accessory liability or?
Great.
Questions from you all that anybody else wanted to raise, either about each other's. Comments.
Okay. Renata agrees.
Says
yes. Get rid of the annoying music. Good.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Good. Any questions on accessory liability that you wanted to talk about? Okay. Great. Good.
we will move forward. One little end note is, like, I would just kind of say, like, you know, accessory liability, this kind of caps, at least, you know, for our first drafts, a lot of these inchoate, you know, general offenses, and, you know, that's a really nice thing to get off the table in terms of, yeah, we've got some further little things down the road, perhaps, but really it's just about, again, doing better and taking into account your comments on the second draft.
So
okay.
Yes. We're not going to get a memo on collusion as an offense in the code?
Oh, yes. Collusion. Wait, is that a crime?
No, collusion is not, but accomplice liability is a crime.
Thank you. Yeah. I've been waiting to make that joke.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Glad it got out of the system.
I feel like that's sufficiently nonpartisan. Pass muster here. Great. Let's move on to kidnapping and the comments we received on criminal restraint. And there were, I'll pull it up on the screen here, a number of comments and there we go. You know, again, so the basic structure of these, right, as drafted, you know, they basically mirror one another. Kidnapping is restraint plus this additional intent. Otherwise, they are essentially the same, and the aggravated forms of each are the commission of the base form, criminal restraint, and aggravated criminal restraint is the base form, commits criminal restraint, plus these kinds of set of aggravators that we've consistently kind of put out for others. So, you know, that's what we're dealing with in terms of basic structure. The comments, various comments, want to go through PDS comments on top of my printout here, so might just start there. One that PDS had made was to kind of clarify that for core liability under particularly criminal restraint, that we in PDS kind of offered a new draft language that would do this, but to clarify that the D version is the 2D when a child's under the 16, that is kind of categorical, which is to say that's the only way one can commit criminal restraint for a child under the age of 16 is through D, and it's categorical if the parent or guardian or such person did not give consent. And that's the clarification they I think PDS was asking for, was that it isn't the case that the parent can consent and yet it is still criminal restraint because under 2A, 2B, or 2C. I think that's important, and I think that's correct. We otherwise have situations where, again,
excuse me.
I don't even know what that was.
That was my computer.
Oh, good. Yeah. Sprayed it with a microphone doing something. Right, we don't want liability otherwise, and again, if they're under 16, there isn't independent authority to differ from their parents as to parental decisions about where they need to be. And same thing goes, another kind of point made in the PDS comments as to guardians. I think we're on the same page and we didn't mean anything different, but we had kind of generally described legal guardian without defining like what particular type of guardianship. PDS made the point of various kinds, and it is definitely, I think, the case that what we mean is legal guardianship that includes physical control or custody of the person. So I think the PDS recommendation in their draft had been kind of to pull that out kind of as a separate, distinct thing and to make that clear in the drafting, But to also make it clear that what we're talking about is we're talking about guardians with the, as they put, as PDS put it in their comments, with the legal authority to take physical custody of that person. And so that is, again, it's physical custodianship. That's the type that we're concerned about. We're not concerned about somebody with a more limited, different type of guardianship with regard to finances or some such. That power of attorney, exactly. So, you know, we definitely, we will clarify that as well. I think that's a point well taken. A couple other points, and kind of the two well the main policy question I think that kind of or difference that is raised in the PDS comments is whether to kind of cast both in kidnapping and criminal restraint, whether it we should have kind of a defense essentially for parents and guardians, or and it's phrased in terms of a broader liability with a defense for reasonable use of typically force by a guardian. Or with physical, who has physical custody over the person, or the parent, or whether it is simply cut out at the beginning.
I'm sorry, before you do
that,
there was one other thing that I wanted to bring up in their memo.
Sure.
When we talk about parents, and then again when we talk about relatives in the other section,
okay,
and there's like exceptions for relatives or parents they're proposing.
Yeah.
One of the things we were thinking about is there's a difference between a parent or relative who has rights within the child
mm-hmm.
and a parent and relative who doesn't have rights.
Mm-hmm.
So me and the mother of my child are separated. I have custodial, I have full custody,
sure.
and she or her grandmother or her mother comes, takes my kid from daycare and disappears with the kid. Now, they may be the parent, or maybe in the other scenario, going to the other section, the grandparent.
Yep.
So while, in concept, having an exception for parent or relative makes a lot of sense, don't we need to think about narrowing it to people who would have the rights that we're expecting to have those rights?
Well, that's a totally different example, right? That's parental kidnapping, which is right. So that's so that's sort of dealt with. But like that's to me, that's not the example, right? That's a separate thing that we can talk about. But that's not this, and that is more getting to the kidnapping with the why did they come take it? Is it because we were going to take it for ice cream?
Yeah, and, no,
is that
that,
a great thing or not? Or are they trying to permanently deprive you? It's to me, and I decided not to tackle it. Because the statutes don't seem to, nor does there seem to be any legislative history, but that's not surprising given when it was written, is the person, I can't think of a scenario that is somewhat benign, who asks your wife, hey, can I take the kid for ice cream? And the wife, who doesn't otherwise have custody, says, sure, have at it, make sure she's, drop her off at her dad's later, please, right? And whether that is that a crime or not, because they haven't maybe really gotten the consent of the right parent.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if it's not these other things,
I don't know that we have a problem with that. So will we have a parental kidnapping that will reach those two issues, both a parent and the non-custodial grandparent? Because as written with the way relative mm-hmm. is put in there,
that's
in my non-custodial parent example, this clearly would not... Grandma could take the kid.
That's right.
Not under kidnapping.
That's right. Not under kidnapping. And it's right.
But why?
Well, I think, that follows the current statute or current liability in the D.C. Code is split between the parental kidnapping provisions and this. We're not claiming to change the parental kidnapping.
Fine. So as long as the parental kidnapping is there.
Gotcha.
But does the grandparent come under the parental kidnapping statute? That was not my recollection.
It it does in terms of relevance, but remember also that in revised kidnapping, it talks about it has a permanently deprived parent, legal guardian, or other lawful custody and right to permanently deprive. So it depends on, so like if grandma is doing it for ice cream, it's not kidnapping, nor should it be. Whether, right. And I don't know whether that counts as parental kidnapping under the sort of formal parental kidnapping, but the grandma taking the kid off to Australia.
Okay, what about the flip? Not Australia, not permanent, but not ice cream. Grandma shows up, non-custodial, and takes the kid for the weekend telling the parent.
That's right.
So it's not permanent.
That's right. And I think, you know, under certainly, you know, with the PDS kind of clarification, no. Temporary takings that are not with intent to do these other things, you know, commit a bodily injury, kidnap a ransom, you know, these other things that are that you get in kidnapping. Temporary, you know, come over to my house, are not covered under either the criminal restraint or kidnapping, whether they fall under the Title 16 parental kidnapping or not. I agree. If otherwise we go forward with expanding beyond just parent or parental, you know, the exception right now in the Title 22 kidnapping, and we include relatives as we pitched here, then we would want to, I think, do a some sort of amendment to check at least that Title 16 mirrors that in some way.
Mirrors
now,
what?
How?
That's not criminal. Grandma takes kid for the weekend?
And
what is it?
Are you kidding me? We're going to criminalize that? If that's a serious problem,
what if it's
go
a
get
month?
A CPO.
What if it's a month? What is it?
Well, I don't know what it means to permanently deprive.
No,
like,
no,
you
no,
know,
right.
So go get a CPO and say, Grandma, you're not respecting this. Yeah. Stay away. But, like, really?
Right. So,
Grandma?
So we would, I think we would.
Uncle, whether the relative definition.
I don't care. Yeah. There's not like there's no way of handling that. But, like, it's a family matter. Really, we're going to prosecute that when who knows what that's about? Right? Like, I don't think we have to make sure we cover that, where somebody's right. first instinct is, like, calling the police and saying this is a crime, as opposed to, Grandma, you can't do that. We've talked about this. She needs to be home for gymnastics. Don't take her for the whatever that conversation is. And if Grandma doesn't respect that, there's probably all kinds of ways to handle that. Sorry, Richard.
No. I would just say this, that whether or not there should be liability in that case, I think it's liability that belongs in the Title 16 version, not in the adult superior court felony, you know, liability here. So that is an issue. I think it's fair to raise and question and put a question mark on that. How does this, you know, how does this scenario get treated then under the Title 16? But we're not there right now. And I would say on all of this, like you kind of mentioned, Laura, there's no legislative history on this. You know, we have this like blanket, you know, parental exception, which by the way we're cutting back on, right, with respect to kidnapping. And PDS seems fine with that when it is kidnapping with some of these other bad intents. You know, a parent takes them with, going to extort ransom from, who knows, you know, the wealthy grandparent, or to commit bodily harm that isn't, and I think PDS would be on board with this, you know, anything beyond what's kind of necessary for, exercise of, you know.
We're only on board after much discussion. Katra was more sensitive.
Okay.
To this than
well, good.
Like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. So, good. So I think, you know, PDS, one of their points, I'll also toss into the mix here, was to, again, exempt from kidnapping liability parents who, again, are restraining them with intent for the lowest level for bodily injury, which again, kind of per our, is grabbing somebody sharply that might cause some pain. Now, as defined, it could also include a punch. So there are questions around that boundary, but what we would do is we would constrain it, and PDS had put in some proposed language to do this. It would essentially say, like, right, again, kidnapping, if it's one of those bad intents listed in the kidnapping statute, again, I can scroll, maybe I can scroll to that. These bad intents to if a parent does any or criminal restraint with any of these, they are liable except under the D, inflict bodily injury. A bodily injury that is part of parental discipline would be okay. So that I think that's a reasonable carve out, right? Like, again, as you kind of raise, whatever, parents are on the hook for restraining their kids until they're 18 and behaving their control. And at times that might involve, you know, a sharp grab, something like this, which we don't mean to suddenly elevate into, you know, a serious felony, but that otherwise the bad intents would kick in even for parents if they the restraint was with these purposes.
Small point of order. Yeah. Should we decouple bodily injury and sex offenses in case we're making collateral references to offenses there?
I think I did in the
PDS proposal. But yes, that's a good
right.
point.
Yeah.
Separate
them. Let's go.
Yeah. I mean, we bodily injury is a defined term. I don't know that it matters one way or the other, but if it would help to clarify it, you bet.
You meant for the, right, I thought you were talking about if you were adding an exception, right? So I did this.
Right.
To add,
I was saying, in terms of specifying the aggravators, if there are certain situations where one aggravator is going to be, has a defense to it, mm-hmm. like bodily injury.
Yeah, might be, yeah.
Simply referring to subsection D rather than subsection D on bodily injury, and then making clear that we're exacting out the sexual offense just might make that a little bit clearer.
Sure, you bet. That's a good drafting point. I think, PDS also kind of put together new drafting. It's good in many respects. There are, I think it does a couple of kind of unintended things, which I think the drafting, your kind of narrative description doesn't quite line up the drafting, but so we can work on the drafting some. And I appreciate your going to the effort to try to, you know, make that language out there. I think the key is more like the substantive points. And then we'll kind of go back and look at how to draft it to that end.
Can I just say something about legislative history?
Okay.
So, I don't know if this is true, but to me it was an epiphany.
Yeah.
And that is sort of thinking about kidnapping, parental exception. I sort of realized at some point in struggling with this that sort of what that exception is, I was filling it in as if the hole was filled by the parental kidnapping statute, as opposed to, right, so like, as opposed to sort of realizing that, in fact, all this other stuff we've been talking about that parents get to do is why you would have had an exception for parents, not a parental kidnapping exception, but an exception because our kidnapping statute is so broad and you are allowed to say, get over there and don't you dare move until I tell you you can, totally fine. And of course, it's going to be written, parents get to do that, strangers don't. And that's the exception. And there is legislative history is on parental kidnapping when, and I don't think it was the Elizabeth Morgan case, but it may have been around there where they were like, shit, that's not actually a crime here. But then there is legislative history on parental kidnapping, which is like late, 70s or 80s. But, you know, what it doesn't deal with is what it means to be a parent. Like, different family structures, don't seem to tackle.
That's right.
But they definitely are like, okay, there's this gap. We don't have this as a crime when a parent's sort of being nefarious with taking their kid. And then they're super thoughtful about it. And then the U.S. Attorney's Office only weighs in to sort of not to say, hey, rewrite kidnapping, mm-hmm. but to have some comments about how it's being separately treated. But they don't actually, it's not, there's like no consideration of rewriting kidnapping or changing the parental exception. It's an exception. It's not, it's a hole in the criminal conduct. It's not, oh, it's because we're dealing with parental kidnapping somewhere else. And so I think the policy that we recommend of it's an exception, not a defense, that's is consistent right. and makes sense.
I would agree that that is more consistent with kind of the way the current code is. We might do a little bit more research on that, just to kind of look at how other jurisdictions are. Are there other pros, are there other benefits to doing this as a defense? In some situations, because it's also, again, kind of in the PDS way of drafting, kind of splits out in the custodian or legal guardian and kind of how that works, particularly with an adult, right? When, you know, I just want to kind of think through carefully again how we're exempting liability versus putting forward a defense in that case. It might apply a little differently for like adult wards, where kind of this is really about the presumption and, you know, who has the burden on this, right? Is it more as a defense or more...
at least raising in the first instance.
That's right. And so I think that question we might want to look at again more... we did not look at kind of how other jurisdictions handle this. Again, with respect to kind of on its face, is there liability for a guardian doing this kind of thing?
Can I ask an adult custodian?
Yes. Somebody who has physical authority.
Of an adult, not the guardian of
exactly.
a kid.
Exactly. Okay. So that is so we might that might be an instance for where having an affirmative defense of not parental discipline, but discipline or correction or safe, you know, like even the language needs to change a bit. We have a parental discipline. But really, when it's with an adult ward, it's about protecting their safety, right? Like, you know, it's slightly different language. And again, we did not examine that before. So I kind of want to leave that a bit open until we look at that prong a bit more in terms of, again, in the first instance, is that blanket accepted? Or is that a case where it's an adult ward?
Oh, are they allowed to grab the arm of the...
That's right. How does that work? And again, are there, you know, there's kind of different, I think, standards. We don't have a good grasp on this yet. So I want to look more at that for the adult wards. Okay. Been a number of issues. If anybody wants to talk about kind of what's out there now, there are a few other points though raised. Otherwise, I'll move on to those. Want to be clear with the adult wards. The PDS comments have kind of made a point of trying to maximize respect for the ward's autonomy, and that's definitely true. Again, how best to do this in the drafting, whether it's an affirmative defense, if restraint is used against them versus are they, is the custodian, the guardian just not involved here? It partly goes again to like, well, if it's not here, where is there liability in some cases, in their Title 16 or somewhere else? So we want to look at that and make sure that we're not inadvertently creating some gaps, or not creating, because the current statute kind of doesn't address this. We're kind of in new territory on this, so just want to do the best we can by that. A couple other points. PDS had raised asking for a Good Samaritan defense, where the criminal restraint is necessary to prevent some other worse outcome, right? You know, stranger sees child near the street corner, you know, yanks them back, and in doing so, they trip and whatever, break a finger or something.
Or just put them in a car to drive them to the police station.
Right? Or yeah, exactly. Or much milder forms, yeah, right? Yeah. Like so, and I would say that we've poked at this a little bit previously. You know, we expect a general justification defense to be applicable across all offenses for Good Samaritan type behavior where somebody is doing a stranger, apparently, you know, otherwise criminal activity with an expectation that it's a good faith effort to avoid a worse outcome, right? This is a, it's recognized in district case law, and we have nothing in the statutes. We, depending on the longevity of our work, you know, we would love to tackle general codifying these general justification defenses. But what it so that is that exists in current law. It's something we hope to tackle, but further down the road, and would cover ultimately exempt from liability a stranger doing this kind of thing. Whether it would do so in as kind of complete a way, as precise a way, as a targeted Good Samaritan defense here, that's arguable. Whether it should be a defense or, again, an exception to liability is another matter. It seemed from your comments you were talking about a defense, right? In which case, I think there's no, like, real change in difference in burden between a Good Samaritan affirmative defense specific to the kidnapping and revised kidnapping and criminal restraint statutes versus a general defense of justification. So, yeah, does that assuage your kind of concerns if we, for instance, and one thing we would do at this point, we could note in the commentary that, right, there shouldn't be this, and you know, for now we would put in some kind of, we like to put brackets around, you know, something in a footnote, you know, this should be addressed in a general codification, the general justification offense. If for some reason that doesn't otherwise happen, you know, we need to make
right. I mean, too. I think if yes,
okay.
Yes. I
okay.
mean,
so that would take care of your concern.
If you weren't going to adopt it,
yeah.
Especially if you think it's a good idea,
yeah, no,
then,
I, yeah.
then some acknowledgement that you aren't rejecting it
that's
because
right.
it's a bad idea,
absolutely.
And an acknowledgement it's because
exactly.
justification, whether you get around to writing something or not, certainly, you know,
you
relying on that, then that would be appreciated.
Great. Yeah, I think we're, so the policy point accepts. I don't know if there's any concern
with
that.
I don't think we have a problem with a Good Samaritan
yeah,
thing.
Exactly.
And I like the idea of a general one.
Yeah.
How the burden of proof is phrased, though, that I'm not going to argue about that now because
that's right.
we'll wait until we
see. That's right. No, and right. And, you know, again, this is the kind of situation across many offenses, you know, assault in general, right? Like,
just about any offense,
yeah,
other than
yeah.
like the extreme sex offenses, you know, like
or maybe any sex offense.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if someone's holding a gun to your head and saying do this sex act, right? But that would be an excuse, not a justification,
right? Right.
Which is a little bit different, but yeah, I mean, for just about every one of these situations, there's going to be, you know, the situation where yeah, there's like a justifying. But that said, I mean, you know, it seems like. It's some that like that the sort of like stereotypical like lesser evil situation will be different for each, and so you know there is like you can understand that intuition to want to like really specify that. One concern is that like if, you know, if we were going to do that, we'd want to do that for every single one and hit
exactly.
every single, because
exactly.
you wouldn't want to lead to like a, you know, a situation where it's like, well, they codified it here but not for the other. So
I think there may be value in, depending on, not necessarily for this offense but other offenses, if there are methods of proof that are non-obvious in terms of what would create the justification or excuse,
yeah.
specifying what those methods of proof look like in terms of justification or excuse, but referencing
the
codification of general applicability.
Yeah.
That's right. If there's something unique about that, I don't know. Nothing leaps to mind for this.
No.
But yeah, that's a good general point where we might both like, have a particular, but reference the general justification.
It might be like a reduced standard if it's like a parent or relative who seems to be doing like self-help against imminently, you know, there are drugs in the home or things like that, and they're just trying to remove the child or something like that, but they don't have an actual claim of custody, but there is some relationship biologically otherwise, but I just wanted to flag that.
Great. All right. Let's see if there were other... Again, besides the kind of, again, tedious... wanting to, you know, kind of accepting the framework where parents are liable for, again, kidnapping with an exception for inflicting bodily injury as necessary as part of parental discipline. Their comments, I think, were parallel between kidnapping and criminal restraint. So I think that covers the ground of kind of what
the issue raised. Can I just make one point? The definition of bodily injury, I think for the most part, it makes sense.
Yeah.
But doesn't it include, like, cutting not more than an inch?
So
how does that, I mean, I can't think in a kidnapping scenario where cutting a kid.
Yeah, no, I
mean, you know, pain is one thing.
You bet.
Like you said, an abrasion is something.
So right now, our operable.
Right terms.
You bet. Our operable definition for bodily injury for the offenses against persons, is, you know, basically drawn from kind of current case law, and it's simply physical pain, illness, or any impairment of
The physical. I must have been thinking of substantial.
That's right. So what's interesting is the substantial begins to, I mean, substantial is part of, and it's something we've talked about and is on the table as for a second draft to limit it to significant pain. As we've been working on sex abuse offenses, that is in the definition of bodily injury for purposes of sexual abuse. Like we have these conflicting definitions. So that remains to be kind of sorted out. We would like, I think, still aspire, and I think it is doable to have an across-the-board standard for this. Regardless, I think the relevant point maybe in your concern here, you know, cut, small cut, things like this, is it's more about the purpose. And I think, like, by limiting, again, exempting from kidnapping liability, a parent's action with intent to commit bodily injury for something other than reasonable parental discipline, that's where, like, you know, yeah, a
and
very
even
small
parental
cut.
Discipline had a lot of, right, if you reference that definition, also was like, it wasn't all actions that a parent might take, right? It was like, not the cut for three. It was like, right, it was like a certain, I don't have that piece, but right, I mean, even that had lots of subsections to it that even limited bodily injury was.
And I think that's what we want. We don't want to like, so yeah, does that address your concern?
Yeah, I just, I just want to bring it up so that we're sensitive to it when you're reviewing it.
So I wonder if referencing assault rather than bodily injury then might be a way to incorporate that, right? Like, so, because what we're talking about is with bodily injury, the concern is that, like, right, there are different forms of bodily injury that may or may not fall within the scope of parental discipline, but then parental discipline is, like, what we're really talking about is, like, was it an assault? Because if it's cutting, even if it's for parental discipline, it's still an assault because cutting is not reasonable parental discipline. You know, and so, or
the nesting in and building off of other definitions can get complicated, which we've talked about before.
Definitely.
The worry with assault, though, also comes in, are you having proven mental state? You know, was the bodily injury inflicted with recklessness?
How all that? Yeah.
So our thought was we could go kind of more just straight to bodily injury, but cabining it by the purpose and like was whatever the injury was, because again,
reasonably calculated.
Right, exactly, right. And again, a punch, these things that are fine, they're still within the realm of bodily injury. They don't bump up even to significant bodily injury, but, you know, are very rarely going to be necessary parental discipline. One can imagine extreme, you know, scenarios where that might be the case, but ordinarily no. So, yeah. Any other kind of questions or concerns coming out of the PDS comments? If not, I'll move on to some of the OAG comments. And on that note, yeah, just a few things. You know, one, OAG had kind of raised just a clarification question about the reference to harm in the aggravators for kidnapping. And you know, that's right. I think what we mean is the loss of kind of personal liberty, whether or not there is physical harm. Because again, even for the aggravators, there are ways to do this that there may never have been, you know, physical harm or mental harm. So, but we can definitely clarify that in the commentary. So that was a helpful clarification. Ask for more kind of, I think, clarification in the commentary about the boundaries of the exception where kind of basically kind of reverting to the kind of pre-Byrd version of liability for kidnapping in another offense, where we would say there's no liability where the interference with freedom of movement was incidental to some other crime. I mean, and OAG is absolutely right, you know, to say that, like, that is not that's a standard, it's not a definition, right? You know, what is incidental is going to vary by case. And we will review that. We had some examples, I think it was footnote 73 in the memo, provide some citations to some of the pre-Byrd kind of, you know, there's some case law that was in that zone in the 70s, early and 80s, where, again, all the courts were operating under this incidental to notion. But yeah, it's the kind of thing which case law is going to have to address, and it is just, I think, kind of impossible up front to spell out, you know, there's just so many scenarios where what is incidental is, you know, as a robber moving the person 3 feet, you know, is that restraint on their movement incidental to the robbery? Is taking them down a long alleyway? Well, then more likely yes. Is it taking them across the city to, you know, a deserted place? Even more likely yes. You know, so these are, you know, we can kind of give some examples of outliers. You know, the most trivial currently, it's kind of like aspartation. You know, it's kind of any degree of, you know, there's no limit on the lower end of bodily movement that's recognized in law. So it's, we clearly want to get out of these de minimis type, you know, kidnapping liability incident to a, you know, small.
That was the alley, right? From the mouth of the alley into the alley.
Exactly.
That's incidental.
These are going to be the places. Yeah. And so, you know, my guess is this. You know, there'll be a further look back at prior case law and standards, and probably reviving that, right? Instead of relying just on the elements test to differentiate robbery versus kidnapping liability, which, you know, might meet an elements test, so there's go at it for each. But right, you know, this will evolve, and again, I mean, you know, relative to robbery, relative to sex assault, right? You know, there are a lot, you know, kidnapping can be an adjunct to many, many crimes. And so, yeah. So we'll try to address that. Maybe, you know, we can review and check and beef up those examples. But ultimately, again, it's kind of as a standard. It's a recognized one in the past. It's used in the past, but hasn't had that precision with respect to, like, upfront laying out how particular hypos are going to be cited.
I was just going to say, the examples that we talked about just then seem to focus more on, like, temporal and spatial proximity rather than facilitating the completion of the act, so language around affecting, significantly affecting, like, the preparation, commission, or success of the offense may be a way of limiting it. I don't know, but that's just a random limiting principle that I thought about.
Yeah, no, that, right, that also...
I mean, it's still fuzzy, but...
That's right. I mean, the liability, in some sense, goes even further to the extent that... and I think this overlaps with what you're saying. You know, one of the other points, in a couple of places, I think, and I don't know if this is kind of a question about what consent means or how we define consent for purposes of the statute, or again, OAG had a couple of comments where, you know, with respect to deception, right, where deception is used, get in the car, and then... and what we had pitched was you incur liability where there is deception accompanied with an intent to resort essentially to physical violence should the deception be uncovered, right? This has been recognized in at least one federal circuit comes to mind off of federal statute, obviously, interpreting the federal kidnapping statute, which is very analogous to us. There's some case law saying they should be, it's like, you know, whatever, persuasive kind of authority, but not binding. The harm, again, is at issue, is the harm, the change to what a person would otherwise have done. Right, so even though a person may consent to the act as it's presented, if it's based on a deception, we would say it's kidnapping. So, for instance, I see Dave on the street, and I'm like, Dave, I just got a call from your wife. You know, there's an emergency. You know, get in the car. I'll take you there. Dave's like, yes. Get in the car, and I drive some, you know, this was all a lie. I made up, right, a ruse. And, 100 miles later, Dave's, what is up? The way we've kind of, so what we've phrased it by allowing for liability based on deception that significantly restrains somebody's freedom of movement, it provides liability, both under criminal restraint, and then if it's with the additional bad intents for kidnapping, for that kind of behavior. But it does open the door, once you start doing this, and you say, like, that it's the fundamental harm is one of not just, like, you know, physically, you know, restraining somebody or even locking them in the room, which is kind of the traditional examples, but essentially... tricking somebody into going someplace that they otherwise would not have gone, right? That's what we're talking about. That is also a broad category, right? And the worry is... That's what surprise parties are, exactly, which we want to criminalize,
that's
clearly.
What you were doing.
exactly. Maybe there's some... Maybe there's a happy ending there. But you know, on the other end, so that's the... The worry is by kind of clearly recognizing this category of interference with a person's, you know, freedom of movement based on a deception, that we open it up too much. And so we're trying to be careful about that while also recognizing, again, this case. And so what we've done is that's why I think we felt the qualifier that it was essentially, again, a deception which, pull up the language, sorry.
Would have failed.
I'll get it on the screen so people can see. And of course, Anna can spell. There we go. All right. this modifier here, provided that if the deception had failed, the defendant immediately would have obtained or attempted to obtain consent by causing bodily injury or threat to cause bodily injury. In other words, you know, part of it is, right, you know, I want to drum up attendance at the whatever event. I say Superstar X is going to be there. And you know what? A bunch of people drop their plans. They come out to the concert, the would-be concert, and instead it's just whatever.
Me
telling bad jokes. Right. You know, we don't want to, right? So, interestingly, a number of circuits have allowed this kind of liability and have explicitly declined to require this kind of proviso at the end, provided that there was, had the deception failed. Again, at least one federal circuit has required this as, again, a kind of a reasonable constraint on this. What you worry about is not so much the kind of luring somebody or enticing somebody where they would have, they were free to go at any point. To do that, you know, so much of what, you know, it just opens up a lot of potential litigation over, you know, the person, you know, deceived me into going somewhere, right, for any purpose. Again, a commercial one. And, you know, like, oh, we don't mean to expand it, but with this qualifier, it puts that, you know, again, there was, again, a coercive kind of end point that may not have been seen up front, but it was intended that this is all to, like, draw somebody out, usually into a situation where they're more vulnerable.
Which, would have made sense to me more if it actually was with the person's consent obtained by deception, and where the deception failed, they actually hurt the person.
To clarify that,
because what you have there, and I think that's what we tried to put in the memo, is
how do you
the deception it? Works. If the deception works...
It's a counterfactual.
Yeah, it's a counterfactual. How the hell would you ever know what the person would have done, let alone had a beyond a reasonable doubt ability to prove it? So I think that was more of what the concern was.
And I think our, you know, response to that would be, you know, it is, it certainly could be difficult. It's very similar to, you know, attempts for many other crimes, right? So the inchoate, proving up, how do you prove up, you know, somebody, you know, showing up with intent to do X. And we had a footnote that addressed this somewhere. But basically,
you show it by their actual actions. The problem in a deception situation is you're keeping the deception going.
That's right.
So your actions are going to be pure. Otherwise, it's not going to be a good deception, and you're going to... you're going to fall out of that one into one of the other categories.
Right.
So that's why we're having trouble coming up with scenarios where it was in a satisfactory deception, yet you would have evidence of what the person would have done otherwise, because the person who was duped was duped.
If he had a gun in his back pocket, or if he told,
how do you even know if he's a gun that he would have used it?
So yeah. Also, I mean, there's a Supreme Court case on this issue called Holloway. It has to do with carjacking, conditional intent, and it was I don't remember the specific details, but it had to do with proving whether or not the carjacker would have caused bodily injury had the person not voluntarily given up their car. I think the majority said that, you know, I think it was based upon evidence where, yeah, the person had done this in the past and, like, had done other carjackings, and when the person hadn't given it up, he followed through on the threat of physical, you know, the threat of physical injury. So, you know, you can imagine someone who did this repeatedly and in situations.
I could see a narrow scope where the proof might be there, but generally I don't know that in a successful deception, that there would be evidence of that second
crime. Yeah, and we certainly admit, you know, it could be difficult. It was footnote 86 we kind of addressed this, but, I think, you know, some of these things, you know, what did the person have a bag packed with, you know, zip ties and handcuffs? Were there statements, you know, prior statements? Was there the, you know, diary entry that I'm going to do X, you know? In other words, you're right, there wouldn't, because it is not complete, right, as with any kind of attempt or inchoate crime, like, you're going to have to rely on other evidence, statements, you know, physical evidence, indicating that intent. Improving intent in any point is always a matter of inference until right. we technology gets a little bit better. We have the magic there.
Brain scans.
So the question is like, what physical, you know, having not yet affected the physical assault at the end, how do you prove the intent to commit the assault at that stage where it's still inchoate, still incomplete? And it may be a difficult burden, absolutely. And it's the kind of thing which, you know, I think highly, you know, depending on circumstances, right? Like, you know, if I had, you know, go to the, you know, picking you up on the side of town, right, or, you know, picking you up outside, let me just give you a ride, and I'm stopped a block away. Now, again, it's you know, where the scenarios where, as a matter of enforcement, right, somebody's going to be caught midway, right? This is a pretty rare slice of events where the deception was used. They didn't get yet to the point, the end point, where there was a coercive threat or bodily injury. I'm stopped mid-transport, as it were. Okay. Well, it's kind of hard to see how that happens, but, you know, get pulled over for a speeding ticket, and suddenly all this kind of comes out, and where are you going, and, you know, this, and then, I don't know.
It's tough for me to see how that would even happen. The deceived person would never know in that situation that even took place to even...
Exactly. I tend to agree. These interrupted scenarios... I'm sorry.
Right?
Say it again.
I'm sorry.
There aren't any puppies. Right, like, come see my puppies. That's how you get the kid in the car. Right?
Oh, okay.
That's how you're like, okay, but there aren't any puppies, so then what the hell were you doing? Clearly you had a nefarious
right,
event.
Right, right. And it's usually going to be post hoc that this would be unraveled, right?
Yeah.
In other words, there's an interruption mid-transport at which point, fine, maybe nothing comes of that. It dissipates. You get out. You're like, oh, I just had a misunderstanding, Dave. Sorry, why don't you get out and walk? You know, seems suspicious. There's, you know, I don't know, some sort of, you know, you call your wife. There wasn't this. You know, you find out, right? You find out that it wasn't, and suddenly you raise concerns. Again,
I just don't see anybody ever prosecuting kidnapping under that scenario.
I think it's a very this is a small sliver. of conduct, and yet it's conduct that...
I'm sorry you took me 8 blocks out of the way in your car. I think this is an attempt kidnapping.
Absolutely.
Under you would have hurt me anyhow.
Absolutely. Yeah, and when you get stopped, the question is, I mean, you know, I dare say if everybody wants to get rid of liability for this, that's another matter. But I think this is a legitimate narrow slice where there should be liability. But we're trying to again keep it from creeping out too much by having this threat. Again, it's kind of a recognized thing in case law. It's come up in other circuits. You know,
how many sidestep am I just saying this is just a substantial step? There's no need. Like all you've done is
right. Attempt. The difference between
specify what looks like an attempt.
That's another way to think about this. Now I think. Leaving it to general attempt liability, an attempted kidnapping,
what do we miss?
You just have a dangerous proximity. So, you know, like how that fits, it's going to be a little bit different. Maybe that would be the preferred way to like handle this. I don't know. In charge.
How would that
work,
though?
So the idea, like, I think it's you get in the car under a lie of some kind, and then, like, I think you get pulled over for some reason.
Yep.
I see some zip ties in the back.
What's going on here?
Right, and so then at that point, there are implements. I mean, it's sort of like a burglary tools case plus kidnapping, like in the same way that. What is normally a completely innocent, non-contraband, like a screwdriver, it's you imputing the intent to use it in a crime later that makes it a burglary tool and not just a tool. In the same way, this way, I have a person, maybe in subsequent investigations, I find text messages that say this is the plan all along. Well, then at that point, it looks really like an attempt. And it's just they never got to the part where he needed to enact the force. It never rose to that level. But presumably, at some point, the rubber was going to meet the road where
that's right.
once they got Dave to where he wanted to, to be.
Yeah.
I don't want to be here anymore.
Yeah, I think that is another this same kind of interruption fact pattern. Would it? I think it would be easier to prosecute under this kind of language with a clear hook than the attempted kidnapping. Otherwise,
the problem with the attempt be that.
How far along are you?
No, not even that. At the moment he got in the car, the crime had been completed. Right? So because he has been...
Well, I think, if I understand Kevin's point, it was like, if we didn't have this, if there wasn't any of this this provision at all, at that point, we don't have a deception provision at all.
I guess the challenge is this.
Then we would still have attempted kidnapping by virtue of the fact that, yes, they didn't get to the point of the assault.
They knowingly interfered with the degree of personal freedom of movement with the intent to do one of these things.
It's not really, they haven't interfered with the freedom of movement yet because they obtained consent on a surface level. So it'd be hard to say, if I said, hey, there's donuts downstairs, and then we went down there, it wouldn't really say, what I didn't interfere with is your freedom of movement. I interfered with, the facts predicate to that decision.
I get that. I'm just reading, to be an attempt, though, you have to meet some of the elements of the offense and attempting to do the others. So that's why what are we left with as the underlying elements that I'm proving the attempt of?
Sure.
And that's why I think you would need to massage this a bit more to get to that.
These are different approaches, kind of the same end. I think, if there's no kind of problem with keeping where we are, I think, frankly, this is the word's not jumping out of your seat. It provides another hook to the government and prosecution. Whereas, again, it may still be the case that you might, on the kind of fact pattern we were talking about, proceed under, a charge of attempted kidnapping. That would be another available path. This adds in another one. And I think, again, it's fairly narrowly drawn. So, again, PDS does not seem to be unduly concerned about it. So... let me see if there's...
As I understand it, that wasn't the point that Kevin was making, and I thought his point was an intriguing one.
Yeah, okay.
About incidental. Mm-hmm. So the example I thought of was I lock someone in the closet because they've discovered my plan to fly a plane into a building. Okay. So that is... incidental in that it is unbelievably minor considering what I'm about to do, but it's more of the facilitating, right? Not the when you say incidental, you mean temporal and
spatial proximity.
Right,
like
exactly.
It happened
exactly.
around it.
Right.
That distinct, right.
Right.
That was a different, yes. I just thought that was
That point still registered and worth it. We'll think about that more again, I agree. Mm-hmm. I agree.
And
what I don't know is whether, I don't know how much that may, or there were only a few cases that came up in the 70s when we were in this pre-bird zone and that incidental to standard was used. I don't know if that was ever kind of interpreted, in this kind of, that kind of fact pattern. It'd be interesting because we may also already have authority, although dated, that would address that.
And I just say that just in writing up the merger stuff, I mean, there are many states that currently apply, for example, the New York state system applied an incidental to standard with kidnapping and have interpreted multiple occasions. I think it's even perhaps a majority approach. So, I mean, the sort of just the administration of an incidental to standard in state, trial.
It's been done.
It's being done currently.
And again, we did it here in the district for a number of years.
Yeah.
Good. Let me just quickly, I think maybe there's just maybe one or two more points to touch on. Let's see. OIG kind of made the point, I just kind of want to make sure we're on the same page again. That about a child willingly going into a car. This is kind of in the next to last point. Child going willingly into the car and happily staying there, then it cannot be shown that the child's freedom of movement has been interfered with. The child has merely been persuaded to stay in the car. I think, again, this partly goes to the what we were talking about, that the core harm here, and it's a tricky one, is it's the somebody would have exercised their freedom of movement differently but for the intervening conduct. The child's consent doesn't avoid, I promise you candy, even if I, you agree to get in the car because of the candy, that doesn't help, right? The promise of it is still, it's nominally consenting to get in the car, but if that deception, and it was, again, kind of had this intent at the bad
yeah, deception. And I agree with that, but I think the point was more the, can you meet the first element? That it's interfering with freedom of movement.
Yeah.
If the person willingly does it, which is a little different than consenting to it.
Yep. And I think that goes to, just what is meant by their person's freedom of movement.
Yeah.
And we address this some. It's in the explanatory notes section also, in the commentary that... it's something we could definitely look at more and just, emphasizing and clarifying, because I agree it's a kind of a critical point that freedom of movement... Here we go. So kidnapping, bodily consent. Where is this? Requires that the person be prevented from moving as he or she would have desired absent the defendant's intervention. So now again, would a statutory definition versus commentary to that effect further clarification of the commentary, but
just
like,
consider it or consider clarifying it,
yeah.
Especially
okay.
In a child instance, it's sort of I just could see spending a lot of time in the Court of Appeals if we don't
unnecessarily. Okay, yeah, we good. We'll definitely take a second look at that. And I think that was it. Unless and your point was fine on the pecuniary value, something of value, that's fine.
Yeah.
And just get rid of that. We just meant anything of value.
Yeah, that's what I assumed, and that's why I didn't take the word out. It's clearer.
Yeah. Any other comments at this point on kidnapping or criminal restraint? I think, again, it'll look significantly different for the next version. To accommodate kind of the clarification, the PS kind of rightly raised about not wanting for persons under 16, we want them categorically, they're handled by this one section. So we will need to rearrange it, very similar to kind of the way PS recommended, pulling out some. So substantively, I think we've discussed the policy points, but how that gets translated into drafting will, and where I can check with you too. I think yours is great on kidnapping. I think it, again, might have done some things you didn't mean it to. We don't need to go into that right now. But great. If there's no other questions on kidnapping criminal restraints, I guess I'd just open it up. The other reports that we sent out but are still pending a review, I don't know how far along either of their offices or Kevin, any of you might have had a chance to review the materials yet. Again, comments not due yet until September 14th, I believe it is. Either on merger, disorderly conduct, public nuisance, failure to disperse, rioting. The other thing I'd say, a couple other things. One, these are in some ways more preliminary than usual. Like with disorderly conduct, we didn't do a national legal trends section because we're going to kind of get a sense first on the statutory language, where that's going to go. Also, frankly, the national legal terms may not be very helpful, because on some of this public order, low misdemeanor stuff, there is tremendous diversity. You know, we hit this with a lot of offenses where, you know, it's hard to like, but, you know, at least every jurisdiction has something called kidnapping. You know, with disorderly conduct type stuff, it goes under many different labels. It's carved up many different ways. It's herding cats to try to piece this stuff together. So, and I would say in general, right? Like, you know, there's leave it at that. If there's questions you have now, again, we're happy to meet individually too.
Just a basic question.
You bet.
So the disorderly conduct and public nuisance, is this meant to replace just 1623-21?
Just very limited. Hold on, let me pull it up.
I haven't, and to be honest, I haven't.
That's totally fair. No, it's the 1321.
It's not even all of it. But exactly. So then when I go into reading this, isn't meant to,
that's right,
to replace all that other stuff.
Public nuisance and disorderly. Disorderly is A as well as a phrase.
Okay.
And public nuisance is
based on a phrase.
Is B, C, C1, D, and
A. Oh, just go a little slower. A's
sure,
and
a
phrase.
It's at the very top of the commentary.
Okay. Oh, yeah. There it is. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's...
Yeah, I mean, because this, you know, is a much more recent vintage, those
sure.
statutes.
You bet.
It doesn't reach the jostling or...
Yeah. Keeping Tom or...
That's right.
That
right.
kind of stuff.
So, I put on the screen, here's the current statute, right? Again, so this was... 2012, Council for Court Excellence came out with, based on a study group, which
you guys were in,
or at least, you know, a number of stakeholders were in, and that came into the council. The council made modifications to that.
Yeah, Mendelsohn
so
had
there were some
definite
significant
opinions
changes.
On this stuff.
That's right. And since then, there's even been kind of further Office of Police complaints. You know, there's been further kind of reporting on this, and you know, so it's dated now. Yeah, really 5-6 years almost. And before this, it was a very different offense. Right now, the core kind of type of conduct, disorderly conduct, is in the subsection A. And how, you know, now may not be the time, but, you know, neither the CCE report nor certainly then the council's report, which, you know, because it wasn't fully relying or accepting the CCE recommendations, it's kind of hard to tell where things were coming from there. You know, this tripartite kind of breakout under A, we've been increasingly trying to understand and, you know, kind of First Amendment limitations and implications, both for this, hits other offenses that we're working on, and whether these were crafted and distinguished the way they were because of those concerns, First Amendment concerns, whether there were other concerns, unclear from the legislative history and the CCE report. Particularly
I might have
with
some of the materials.
Exactly.
On my
so, if there's additional background on that, would love to hear it.
I'll
this
check.
Again, the revised disorderly conduct is just the subsection A and a phrase are the corresponding pieces, and then what Patrice said was the public nuisance. The revised public nuisance covers the subsections B through D. And as we kind of say, I think it was in the memo, or we did urination was discussed in nuisance. We're also, one thing we are recommending is just elimination of liability under subsection E. which was a...
Urinating in public?
That's right.
It was a what?
We're recommending elimination of liability for that period.
See, that goes over. Because urinating in public is something that we get police get a lot of complaints about. Defecating was added in 2012 because there were some people who had been arrested for it, and it turned out while it was illegal to urinate, it was not illegal to defecate. Huh. And much to the chagrin of the people whose lawns it was on.
There we go. Yes, it was a closely debated thing in the CCE. I think the report said that maybe even said a majority were sympathetic to the fact that it should not be criminal, but for lack of a more robust civil enforcement system, that for that reason, enough votes kind of swung towards keeping it in. There was again kind of similar reference in the council level as well, that while it perhaps should not be criminal, that without other kind of civil remedies for to deal with this, and so yeah, our recommendation, you know, this is something that we don't see in other jurisdictions, and you know, in our review, it seems like it should not be criminal conduct. There would be liability where it damages property, right? We have a general property damage, and so you know, potentially there's liability where it damages property. We have liability for somebody exposing themselves, you know, publicly in the process of urinating or defecating. But the, you know, the mere fact of having done this, there were also, you know, some concerns about, although relatively minimal, there was testimony from some representatives of kind of the homeless, saying that as enforced, there were few instances where it appeared to be against homeless persons, or at least, you know, it's often I'm
clear in a
number of cases.
It came up most often in those days by people leaving bars late at night, walking past people's properties on their way.
Yep. So I, you know, look forward to everybody's comments, whether this is a, you know, we haven't generally encountered, and again, this is the first time we've kind of dipped to lower level kind of offenses, fundamental questions about, you know, is this criminal conduct or not? And this raises it, and it was raised and debated, you know, seemed to be a close call 5-6 years ago, and
one of the things, just for people to consider whether it matters or not, is that one of the issues that keeps repeating itself when the council seeks to decriminalize something is that we don't have, and for a lot of reasons either can't or won't have, effective civil remedies to offenses that are not somehow tied to licensure or some other sanctionable thing. Because I think MPD did a test. It was either like jaywalking or littering or something like that. And like 85% of people never responded to the tickets. That the only time that there was something was if you needed licensure or something tied. Also, the city does not require people to carry identification. So short of saying you're Mickey Mouse or Obama, the police were required to write tickets to whatever name they were given. So that's, by way of background, part of, I think, why the council kept that as criminal, because I think Kelly O'Meara testified about that in hearing. Just
good,
good that.
No, I appreciate it. Yeah, we've looked
at it. But that's why,
if
people can come up with a system of decriminalizing that is effective, I think people would love to hear it.
Go ahead.
I had a few questions.
Sure. Well, so let me just make one other point then before I kind of move into like the actual. So in just, again, kind of how the current disorderly conduct is broken out, And then what Patrice said, so if you look at the screen, you know, the F, G, and H, well, H is just the sentencing provision.
Yeah.
F is the kind of the peeping Tom, stealthily looking. That will be addressed separately at a later date. And then G is the jostling, which, again, we will also deal with separately. It's, you know, this goes to the strange way that pickpocketing type activity is currently handled, right? We have this, we have then straight up robbery that would cover any pickpocketing.
There was also testimony that the jostling went further than the kidnapping, with the pickpocketing, which is why it's worded that way. The shoulder bump,
right,
kind of situation.
Yep. So these are not addressed in the materials right now. But sorry, with that kind of just overview, Laura, you had some questions to raise.
So probably some stuff we can talk about offline. And raise in the September meeting if it seems worth it. But I have one question I'll ask about disorderly and public and public nuisance, and then a couple of questions about failure to disperse. So an easy one, just about public nuisance at page 13. So public nuisance requires that the person be in a location that is in fact open to the general public.
Mm-hmm.
And no, that's not it. It has to do. Oh, I'm sorry. No. That's not what I meant to focus on. That part of committing it is engaging in conduct that causes an unreasonable interruption of the orderly conduct of business in a public building.
Mm-hmm.
And the public building is a building occupied by the District of Columbia or federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And at page 13, you say, clarify, that subsection is to clarify that a public building is a building that's occupied. There's definition. Accordingly, the subsection does not apply to efforts to dissuade customers from patronizing a privately owned business. And I was curious what happens when there are efforts to dissuade customers of a privately owned business in a building that is occupied by the D.C. government or federal government. Because, you know,
it's in the coffee shop
because
in the bottom.
What's that?
Right, we have
because
right down here.
Because there's a coffee shop in the bottom, because Chick-fil-A is in the bottom, and there's a bunch of D.C. government agencies above. That building seems like a big thing,
gotcha.
And in fact might have more than one tenant, and so I just sort of wasn't...
Yeah. No,
I understand your example, and I don't think that we discussed that specific example where somebody was picketing in front of the fire hook that's inside of the courthouse or something like that. But it did seem like the council's intent with that part of the disorderly statute was to keep people from interrupting the actual meeting itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if people were standing outside of room 500 during a hearing, they wanted something comparable to what we already have on federal grounds and in the Capitol. Wasn't really meant to address.
I guess I was more concerned when it sort of talks about the orderly conduct of business as opposed to a public meeting going on, right? So, like, so I might not, and it's purposeful, but, like, I know what I'm doing. So, like, the fire hook in the courthouse strikes me as, like, you know you're in the courthouse. But the cafe downstairs or whatever, right, like, when you walk into a building and it turns out D.C. government happens to have, you know, Orca's got an office up there somewhere, Pretrial Services has an office up there somewhere, and I'm downstairs protesting Chick-fil-A, but the people who have their business trying to get to Pretrial Services, I am interfering with that. But like, so it is maybe the purposeful...
Can I ask you a question? What is public building?
So public building is defined the same way here as it is in sort of like the trespass distinction.
It's there five.
That is occupied. So,
right.
And I think that goes to your point. What does it mean to be occupied?
Right.
This building is not owned by D.C. government.
Right. Because
so what does it mean to be...
There are some buildings that are used by the government that are not owned by the government, and there are, I believe, some buildings that are owned by the government
that are not used, but
to,
yeah,
to other places.
That's right.
So that's sort of our common sense understanding of what a government building is. It's a building that's
so to Laura's point, if let's say OHE is doing rehabbing the sixth floor of the civil, because they need to make room for the civil division, and they rent out space at that building across the street, so they take the fifth floor of it, of an office building, for a year. Does that convert the public, is that the public building? I mean, that's where you're going to, right?
So, right, so I have no proposal on it. It was more of a, is it a scenario you thought about it, and it seems like one we should tackle? I don't necessarily, right. So because it seems less about the building, right, than it's about
subunits in it or something like,
right,
that.
Like right, purposefully trying to interfere with government. Isn't that
which
the
is,
issue?
I think that your understanding of the word interruption might be a little different than how I conceptualized it, because it isn't just, oh, you're being noisy and that's annoying. It's actually interrupting the business that's going on. So, for example, if you were interrupting a council hearing where they cannot conduct the hearing because people are being disruptive. It's just,
let me just interrupt myself to say maybe the answer is it's purposeful, and when I am downstairs protesting Chick-fil-A, which I am purposely doing,
right,
I am not purposely interfering with, well, I'm interfering with the orderly conduct of business conduct of business in a public building. I'm just not purposely interfering. What?
Would you, if you added in public
business in a public building?
No,
maybe
but,
you,
not? But
that's what you.
But
were,
I have a different take on that, because I don't think that it should be tied to the public building at all. Let's say the city council gets invited down to, I don't know, some facility in Ward 7. That has nothing to do with the government, but they're going to have remote hearings there, and I think they do
that,
from time to time, right?
At the ARC.
Whatever, at the ARC Center, yeah, right? And it's not a public building, it's a museum, yep, and people interrupt the meeting. Sure. Why should it be a public? I think it's more about the meeting, right, than about the location, isn't it? Does that help?
Yeah, it's interesting. It raises, both of your points, like if what would Laura's concern, the key is that it's the public business that's being interrupted, regardless of the, you know, so it isn't, you know, right. Having one government office in one corner of the building doesn't convert interruptions to any business in that building,
right,
into like liability.
However purposeful.
And Dave's point on the flip side is in a non-public, totally non-public building, there should be liability where there's like a public business being conducted. So it seems like in both cases, right, the kind of more conceptual part of it is not so much about the nature of the building or the ownership or the occupation, as the nature of what's going on in it. Now, this is all. I think this is good. This is a good insight. I don't know how we think about it some more. So the current law, just go back, flip to it, is ambiguous, right? Like there isn't much legislative history on this place open to the general public and in the community, communal areas of multi-unit housing. Right, you know, this was ambiguous. This is partly why we were trying to define some of these terms and narrow, you know, what does it mean to be open to the general public? Does, you know, is every Starbucks, you know, open to the general public?
I think it is. Yeah, I think they meant to.
They have their policy now that they seem to be, at least during store hours, okay, it's not. What if it's, you know, they've closed their doors
but
and they're having...
But you still have that for disorderly conduct. This is public nuisance.
That's right. I'm sorry. This language. I'm sorry, Laura. You're absolutely right. You know. So that goes for the A, which we've tried to make consistent. This is partly what the A application to open to the general public, and then the B through whatever it is D versions, which again talk about, for instance, here the orderly in that public building in a public building. Here, a public conveyance.
Oh yeah.
You know, so what we've been trying to do is we're trying, like, and again, there's no no definitional anything behind this. So we were trying to create
it
kind of a
be
systematic.
History, because I thought we talked about public conveyances.
The legislative history with respect to C1 is what I was describing before, which is it really was about disrupting a hearing. And your point is well taken that sometimes we have these off-site council hearings even, which are exactly what sort of the point was, that might not actually be in a public building. And I think in an effort to sort of try to make it consistent with the other public-private building distinction in the other statute, that might not have really captured what we wanted to capture, so we should look at it more closely. But we do have this sort of nesting of like what public means in terms of where the person needs to be and what public means in terms of the nature of the meeting that's being interrupted. So
let me ask a question. For example, the D.C. Court of Appeals goes to Howard University to hold oral argument, and for the hour or whatever, 2 hours that they're there, they're required, you know, to make Howard University, like whatever hall they're in, open to the public. Does that qualify as a public building, or is a, right, can something become a public building for a period of time, or is public building something that is, it either is or it isn't?
I think most current statutes refer to it as a place owned or occupied by the district government.
Okay.
For most current statutes here. You could do some. I would need to look. There would be references to certain procedures that. So if it's a council hearing, for example, you could make specific reference to things that have like a formal roundtable. Like there are notices that have to be sent for things like that to convene a hearing like that.
Yeah.
That would make it sufficiently official to reference it in this situation. That would be different from a council member going to like a community event in a town hall where it's their business, but it's not council business.
Renata's ready to call in.
Of course she is. Cool. Let me hold on.
I think there would be ways to draft language to refer to those specifically convened public hearings outside of the council that are not going to necessarily be district owned space.
Anyway, thing to grapple with. Can I ask a couple of questions about failure to disperse in writing?
Sure. Yes. Hold on just a second. Let me.
This free conference call is provided by Uber Conference. You are the first participant on this Uber conference.
Let her know we're.
You wait for the others to join.
Here. Now we're going to have a brief
interlude.
See the
link to this conference by text. Press 3.
I said we're setting up the conference call line now. Okay. Great. I'll write call in anytime.
Yeah. Meanwhile, one point just to kind of tag on to this is, again, like the First Amendment implications on some of this might be significant, right?
Like, there's obviously just to say, like shutting down ICE, right? Like, it's also, like, you're talking about public meetings, but, you know, I don't know. Right? I'm trying to go interfere with what Homeland Security is doing.
We'll make sure to record this for posterity.
What I want recorded for posterity is all of us singing along.
We should, like, one time.
We'll all be singing around in our heads the rest of the day.
I think. Hi, Linda. Renata joining by Uber Conference.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, Renata, for joining us. Welcome. We've got Laura and Kevin and Dave and
Alicia,
Washington. So sorry. And all the staff except for Janu, who's taking some leave right now. And we are right now towards the last 10 minutes or so of the meeting. We're actually in.
We were discussing abolishing ICE. Is what I had just brought up.
Yes.
That's actually true.
You don't have to respond to that. Probably best if you don't.
Am I lying?
So we're on disorderly conduct, which again, people to various degrees cracked it open or not yet. This is the outstanding report. Comments aren't due until September 14th. But we were talking about disorderly conduct, and then I don't know if we were moving on to the failure to disperse or was.
Oh no! Just to sort of say, we were talking about First Amendment considerations with interfering with public with government business,
right?
Not just sort of.
Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Oh, sorry, I have a Thin Mint in my mouth. I said we were just talking about First Amendment considerations of, we were sort of actually more talking about public nuisance than disorderly conduct and interfering with the conduct of business in a public building, which seems like the context of the bill, of the current law, was like interfering with council hearings, and I was just giving the example of interfering with other government business like Homeland Security, ICE stuff, but that having perhaps some First Amendment tone, you know, aspects to it, and some...
Oh, right. Yes, I see where you are.
Yeah.
We could spend hours talking about the First Amendment stuff, but I just wanted to point out again that I do think that there's like a very slight distinction between interfere and interrupt, and so I would like just keep that in mind as well, but that I think that there are going to be sort of First Amendment considerations for all of these offenses that we can probably discuss more at length.
We're spending a lot of time combing through it, and again, to the extent that the First Amendment considerations played into prior thinking, conversations that you know of, or going forward, again, like, you know, any of this new stuff, it is we're for the kind of the first time having to really wrestle with some of these First Amendment issues in a way that we haven't with other traditional property crimes, offenses against persons. Threats could have brought this up, but given the recent Alanis and Carol en banc decision, we were able to kind of carefully track that. Some of the remaining offenses against persons and these public order offenses, dealing with disruptions in public places, or, you know, like in stalking, they've definitely got First Amendment, like, they are, we're taking a closer look at this, I would say. So, you know, any thoughts you have and your offices have on this stuff, great. But we're trying to be very careful about that. Laura, you had another point?
Before your Laura's question, could I just mention to Renata, if you have any materials from the CCE report from 2011 that are, aside from the actual finalized report, that you want to share with me, that would be great, because I think Dave is also going to look and Laura is also going to look to see if there are any other documents from that working group that might be helpful for me to review.
Yeah, definitely. I will, I'll go into my files and, yeah, I'll pull all of that.
Thank you.
So failure to disperse, I might have the answer to my question. I'm going to read what I wrote.
Before you do that, which failure to disperse in the...
Failure to disperse is in Report 24.
Report.
It's at page
report
24.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's why.
So there's a strict liability piece of it. Strict liability always makes me nervous. So here's what I wrote to myself. Object to strict liability.
Okay.
And then I went on. At a minimum, a defendant should have to have some mental state about their continued presence substantially impairing the ability of police to stop the course of disorderly conduct. Partly because I won't otherwise know that I should disperse in order to do so, right? I'm lawfully in an area. I have nothing to do with the disorderly conduct. I'm waiting in line for cupcakes and there's like some disorderly conduct going on across the street. Or like I don't realize that my being in line for cupcakes is substantially impairing the ability of law enforcement to stop what's going on in the street. But here's my question is, right, is my concern addressed by the knowing part of my failing to obey a police officer? So when the police officer says, everybody leave the area, is it not knowing when I'm like, well, he can't mean me because I'm just standing here getting cupcakes and I've got, like, why would he be talking to me?
I think your concern is actually addressed by the term immediate vicinity, which is supposed to match sort of the language from Matthews about this course of disorderly conduct is occurring close enough to you that you can see and hear what's going on. And so the fact that you have to be in the immediate vicinity of a course of disorderly conduct...
Oh, I see it. It's going on right there in the street. I'm just over here. Like, when the police... Right? Because... And the only reason why I'm being told to disperse is because, for some reason, the police, reasonably or not,
right? May not. No, I guess this is an objective standard. That my presence in some way is substantially impairing the ability of a law enforcement officer, which maybe is its own thing, that it's objective about whether the police officer, whether I'm really interfering. I don't know who thinks that. Like, who makes a judgment about whether I'm substantially impairing? But you have this as a strict liability thing. I don't realize that my standing there has anything to do with breaking up that disorder. I can see it. I'm watching it. That's not my purpose for being there. I'm in line for cupcakes. But I see it going on, right? I'm not even, like, not only am I not participating, I'm not one of those folks who's like, well, that's kind of, you know, interesting. Let me watch the protest going on there. I see it, but I don't have anything to do with it, and I don't realize I'm in the police officer's way, and they say, everybody's got to leave the area. I think, yeah, fine, get those people out of the way, because I don't want anyone bumping into me while I wait for cupcakes. And I don't, and I knowingly, as in, like, I hear that order, I'm staying here. Is that a knowing failure to obey, or is my failure to perceive that they're talking to me, is that my excuse?
Is
it not knowing never had any idea
that's
you met
right.
me?
That's right. If the officer is facing the other direction, you didn't...
Everybody clear the street.
You did not know that the order was directed at you. You had a, you know, you had a reasonable mistake.
I'm not doing anything wrong. He can't possibly
that's right.
mean me.
That's right. If you truly didn't have the mental state of, you know, knowing that you were disobeying a police order, right, that would be your defense. And with failure to prove that up, that you had that mental, that you knew that, you would not be liable.
Okay, so then we go to court, and because I didn't just... I didn't know he meant me. I don't know how I want this to work out. Here's what I'm worried about. Who's figuring out whether I substantially impair the ability of law enforcement?
That there's strict liability with respect to whether it's substantially impairing. So the person doesn't have to know...
Can the police officer be wrong about it? Or is it just the police officer's judgment about, like, it really actually would have made my job a lot easier if the cupcake line would have just gone?
Right.
When really... No, right. Just go do your job across the street.
Is this a subjective standard that's from some person's point of view, like the law enforcement officer or the person, the defendant?
Does the jury get
objective,
to say?
Or is it an objective question of fact?
Go do your job.
And I think the way we've, I don't recall if we've addressed this specifically, but it's kind of written up, and we can look at this more, as an objective a matter of fact for a jury,
because
right?
the lawfulness of the order, right? Like
right.
the well, you don't look behind the officer issuing the order,
right?
So it doesn't get trapped up in a, like, maybe the officer had a completely malicious intent, like it wasn't lawful and the officer knew it. That
we don't go there.
But there is still something objective about this piece of the law of the law enforcement response.
I think it's covered by the in fact too, like in that it describes both a mental state and an actual
that this was the
matter
case.
Of yeah
right they're right well right so
in fact
right another way like that. You mental state aside, you have to establish this that the person's continued presence. And so, you know, if this ever right, you know, we actually have a bench trial on this here, you know, like, you know, it'd be, you know, call the officer to testify, look, here's what happened. Here's what I saw. I couldn't, you know, I couldn't diffuse the situation that was going on without the, you know, clearing the street. I thought we had to clear the street. And so I issued the order. The guy was standing right there. they may have been clueless or not, but I can tell you, I was, you know, I spoke loudly and clearly. They saw what was going on as well, and with that kind of evidence out there, right, then the fact finder has to come back and kind of say, right, it doesn't matter that the, in fact, they may have had different opinions. The person on the sidewalk didn't think you were, like, had to move, right? Like, you didn't think you were interfering with the officer's ability to deal with the thing in the street. Doesn't matter.
Right.
But what matters is,
officer, you didn't actually have to make her move because she
right.
wasn't
and
substantially
that,
impairing.
That's
so
right. And that will be a question
call on
of
that,
fact.
So fine that she stayed there in the cupcake line.
That that would be a question of fact for the fact finder. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. That's
okay. Then maybe.
I think Patricia, you like, does that
yes,
make,
I agree that the, that would be a defense that someone says, look, they were not in fact substantially impairing the officer's ability would be a defense that's available. They want to make clear that the person doesn't have to necessarily know that. It's just an objective thing that has to be proved at trial. They just have to know that they were in the
failing to obey.
Yeah.
Okay. I just sort of didn't. I was more worried about why someone might fail to obey, as in I'm not following the order just because I think I'm not doing anything wrong. So why he's not talking to me?
Now,
okay.
One general point to make on this, we put in the preface, but this specifically codifies the DCMR 18-2000.2 failure to, there's a much more general, the language is down, so I can blow it up, but, as with most of, certainly of DCMR, but like also, the mental states aren't here, it's very general how current law is on this. So essentially this is a specific application of the general power of that we have not yet revised that language, right? That potentially raises all this language in the DCMR raises all the concerns that you have.
Well, that requires a lawful order, doesn't it?
That requires a lawful order, absolutely.
Any order under this would have to be a lawful order, sort of by definition, with all of that going on.
If it was all truly going on.
If you proved it, right. So, and again, in other places, lawful orders haven't been, the defendant, maybe it's some things we haven't yet gotten to a defendant's misunderstanding as to whether it was lawful or not would make a difference. Generally not something we've had to deal with. So, I just wanted to point out that this, the kind of whole failure to disperse regime, while it fits in, and again, it's a standard thing that you see in these other jurisdictions that dovetails with rioting, dovetails with disorderly conduct, for whatever reason, we don't have currently in the district. What we do have is this more general kind of authority that is used, in the DCMR, and so this is kind of a way to take a specific instance and control it and be more careful in kind of articulating it and codifying it.
And the location does not matter.
He's
in the DCMR, it does.
That's...
you'd have to be in the immediate vicinity of a course of disorderly
conduct. No, but you don't have to be on a public street or...
Well, the course of disorderly conduct by definition has to be in public because disorderly conduct has to be in public.
But the...
Yeah,
regulation only pertains to pedestrian or vehicular traffic.
Right. So,
it's
so
currently
I think
I'm
the
not
intersection
saying I have a problem. I haven't read it. So I don't.
If there was disorderly conduct in the Starbucks?
You're in the vicinity.
Trying to get the public media like these. These different intersecting things, it's worth thinking through if there's a hypo where it would somehow...
Where it would not occur on the street, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, and it...
Because it would be trespass then, though. That's the thing that you're trying to get around with this stuff, is that disorderly conduct, like in private property, has a whole suite of options because they have control over it. It's only in public places where you have to have these general rules of applicability.
And right now, it's limited to streets and...
The current failure to obey.
Yeah,
that's all I'm saying. I'm not opining on this at all.
That's right, and I think we think it almost completely overlaps with public space by virtue of the fact that the disorderly conduct has to be occurring.
But it does. But it only has to be in the vicinity.
In the vicinity of. So right, does that open up a little slice of that? We'll think about that. I don't know if you have any. I should say it's 12:00. I don't want to hold people over.
Can I just have a quick, easy drafting thing?
You bet.
The difference between failure to disperse and rioting, and I don't know if it's purposeful.
Okay.
Say.
Is this about the numbers?
But I haven't heard it.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so this is a person commits failure to disperse when, in fact, the person's in the immediate vicinity of a course of conduct being committed by five or more persons,
mm-hmm.
not five or more other persons, and then... Rioting is commits disorderly recklessness to the fact that four or more other persons in the immediate are simultaneously engaged. So I'm just trying to figure out what
that's
are the
right.
numbers.
When
are the,
right.
what are the?
So the idea is sort of to match what our definition of rioting is now is five or more persons. So if you're engaging in it, there need to be four or more persons. If
you and
you need to be in the immediate vicinity of five or more persons. Like you basically need to be in the immediate.
But there's five or more
riot.
Other. For fail, no.
That's right.
It's
failure to disperse.
It's them rioting. My only sin is being near them.
No, okay. Rioting, so I'm in it. There have to be four. Riot, what?
So
what?
A person for failure to disperse doesn't necessarily need to be a rioter if we're thinking of it in that sense. They just have to be someone who's near it and is not getting out of the way.
Oh, so we have to... Wait, but it has to be five or more other.
Is it the...
Correct.
But
right.
this is the question which... Is it the person, does that have to be five or more people who are subject to the disbursement? Or is there five or more people who are involved in the disorderly conduct?
Involved in the disorderly conduct.
Yeah. Okay. So the five or more person goes to disorderly conduct, whereas
so
the rioting, you're not anything to do with the disorderly.
Yeah.
You don't have to be, you don't have
for
to be
failure to disperse,
yourself.
You're just a bystander.
To fail to disperse.
And there have to be five people doing disorderly conduct.
Yes.
And for rioting, I can be...
You are one of the five.
There
also
has to be
five
people, but you have to be one of them.
That's right.
Failure to disperse is there's a riot going on. You as a bystander are near, and I as an officer am trying to stop the rioting, but you're somehow stopping me.
Yeah.
But
hold on. So there have to be five people for failure to disperse, but they don't have to be other people. I could be one of them.
You're right.
But there have to be five people.
Yeah, there have to be five
That's
people.
That's why other
way,
is left
you
out.
You just don't have to be one of
I
them.
I may or may not be one of them in failure to disperse, but
That's
there must be five.
Right.
I see.
That's
okay, thank
right.
you.
And just one last question then. So when you say in A, in immediate vicinity of the disorderly conduct is defined in 22A 4001. Oh, so it doesn't have to be rioting. It could be any disorderly.
That's right.
Okay, so it builds the same way as the rioting builds.
That's right. It's based...
That, I just wanted to make sure I was reading that correctly.
Conduct.
Got
that's
it. Okay.
So, failure to disperse could say being committed by four or more other persons. Because I might be the fifth, but I might... No? No.
No,
because we need... Five.
You need five in a disorderly.
And it could be me.
It could be.
Right.
So we don't want other. Right.
Yeah.
It's only four. That's not enough. Okay, I want five or more, but not other.
Right.
Or you don't want other. I like other, but I'm not getting it. Okay, got it.
Yeah.
But it's not different from the other. Fine.
Okay.
It's going to be like five versus six, depending on how you're approaching it, which just seems weird.
Okay.
So you could be the one of the disorderly conduct people or somebody next to a disorderly conduct.
What, Renata?
Can I have a 10?
Yeah, I was just agreeing with Dave that you could either be one of them or there could be five of them and then you're just standing there with your cupcake looking crazy.
I've got my cupcake yet. That's why I'm still
You have your cap that says official observer.
Once I get
you say you're not allowed to be arrested if the cap says official observer.
Sorry,
Kevin has one last
I
question.
Like that idea. Rather than having flowers, you go and you have
That's
a cupcake.
We're going to write that in as the
Very good.
This is just the places that require special permission. I was thinking of places that are only available to district residents as just an interesting hypo there. So public pools, for example, you need to be a district resident. Generally, you need to be a district resident or pay. So I just don't know. Or public libraries, things like that, where there's a sort of public element, generally speaking, but it's sort of premised on you being a resident.
Huh.
Interesting.
And how that might affect.
We'll think about that too. How that goes into the mix. Great. Thank you all. Again, we're tied over time, but next meeting again is September 5th, I believe. Sorry.
Yes.
Again, happy to meet individually with anybody between now and then, if that's useful. Yep. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.